Notably, in no case was the Savior God, despite being conceived from the start as a historical person, ever an actual founder of any of these religions. Yet they are always portrayed as such in their sacred stories, issuing teachings and prophecies and establishing, quote-unquote, their church. The earliest documented of these uprisings was the Vailala Madness in the territory of Papua. But all subsequent cults had similar features. They are all charismatic apocalyptic cults, in this case arising in Melanesia, characterized by glossolalia and mass hysteria, prophesying, receiving secret communications from God, who thus provided instructions on forming the religion and its teachings, and experiencing powerful and convincing visions. Thus, cargo cults were schizotypal cults, as we discussed in Element 15. In fact, in several documented cases, things that were seen in visions or merely prophesied were later believed to have historically happened. Within just 15 years, some such ideas originating in 1919, becoming fully historicized beliefs by 1934, demonstrating rapid legendary development. Cargo cults were also characterized by radical reform, abandoning old traditional cult and instituting a new, as well as apocalyptic expectations, preaching a coming end of the world in which all injustices would be redressed, the dead raised, and the faithful rewarded, and a strong moral dimension, as well as new diversions of charity from which the movement's leaders benefited, similar to what the letters of Paul show happened in early Christianity. Peter Worsley's study of cargo cults and related millenarian movements, such as the Native American ghost dance movement of the late 19th century, found that they arise in one of three conditions, though sometimes more than one condition is present, and notably, all three were present at the origin of Christianity. First, in racially and culturally fragmented societies. Quote, the main effect of the millenarian cult is to overcome these divisions and to weld previously hostile and separate groups together into a new unity, end quote, against the ruling power. And, quote, the social necessity which produces this drive towards integration is the subjection of all the separate units to a common authority, end quote. Like, for example, a foreign imperial power, and, of course, the local elite who support it, who are then seen as in collusion with it. Christianity, too, arose in a racially and culturally fragmented society under the thumb of a foreign power. The first Christians sought to resolve this tension by recruiting Gentiles to become Jews, but very soon Paul saw, consciously or not, that Christianity had to relax that requirement to achieve its goal of unity, making this an almost inevitable development, since the need of it would have been all but obvious, while the alternative was certain to fail, as in fact it did. And the second major type of society in which millenarian cults develop is the agrarian and especially feudal state, where, quote, the cults arise among the lower orders, peasants and urban plebeians, in opposition to the official regimes, because, due to the material conditions of their lives, they lack any organization which could give practical expression to their common interests, and they do not see their common interests except in times of social crisis, end quote. So they must then create such an organization. Christianity likewise originated in an agrarian society, with an effectively feudal structure, with powerful landholders controlling economic and political institutions and exploiting a peasantry. And it arose among the lower orders in a condition of growing social crisis, as we see in Elements 22 to 25 and Element 4, where no political organization for expressing their concerns was made available, thus necessitating that they create one. This would explain Christianity's rapid organization into churches, with a hierarchy and rules of order, and its steady move toward control of orthodoxy through an increasingly organized political system independent of the imperial government. This same pattern is observed in other cases. Most millenarian movements begin with a, quote, terrific release of emotional energy, end quote, and, quote, the overthrow or reversal of the present social order and the promise of heaven on earth soon, end quote. But this revolutionary aspect has a brief life. If the movement survives, it does so only by becoming an institutionalized expression of a more distant future promise, with more muted emotional energy and more socially conservative, just as happened to Christianity. And there is a third type of social situation in which activist millenarian ideas are likely to flourish, which is, quote, when a society with differentiated political institutions is fighting for its existence by quite secular military political means, but is meeting with defeat after defeat, such that when the political structure of a society is smashed by war or other means, or fails to answer the needs of a people who wish to carry on the struggle, then a prophetic, often millenarian leadership is likely to emerge, end quote. In other words, when the military solution to oppression and social dysfunction so consistently fails and is so obviously unlikely to succeed, social pressures produce apocalyptic, non-militarized grassroots movements instead, which arise from a retooling of the dominant native religion. Apocalypticism, both its eager expectation and its florid description through revelation and pronouncement, becomes a way to passively voice discontent with the ruling powers and re-envision a better society, proclaiming that God himself will bring it upon us soon, rather than taking up arms to bring it about directly, a solution already seen to be incapable of success. And since it must happen, as God would not abandon his people, God must be waiting in the wings. This so appositely describes the situation and solution of earliest Christianity, elements 22 to 25, that it is again a conspicuous match. So the sociological situation that spawned Christianity had all three conditions for generating millenarian cults exactly like Christianity. In fact, these are now recognized as the common conditions giving rise to all martyrdom movements, from Islamic to Buddhist to pagan, Jewish, and Christian. A subject people, in relative poverty, powerless, effectively dominated by a foreign people, either directly or through collusion with an unresponsive local elite, who are racially and culturally different from themselves, and whose economic and military capability is so awesome it cannot be overcome. Anthropology thus teaches us that Christianity is exactly the sort of thing one would expect to arise in those conditions. And we should also expect it to take on the characteristics typical of those conditions. It would arise from an oppressed native's religion, Judaism, in a time of escalating unresolvable crisis, as in early first century Palestine, and it would prominently adopt martyrdom, apocalypticism, a program of social moral reform, and its own internal political organization separate from the established political and religious institutions. It will also syncretically merge, per element 11, its local faith with useful or admired elements of the cultural and religious ideas of their oppressors, in order to co-opt them and produce a greater religion than either the failed local cult or the illegitimate alien cult, as all these other millenarian movements did. When the conditions are added that strongly support schizotypal cult behavior, as we saw in element 15, the features thereof will be integrated as well, as happened with the cargo cults. And when the further condition is added of a rising popularity of syncretic unification movements, such as the Hellenistic mystery religions, as we saw in element 11, we could again have described what Christianity would look like without ever having heard of it. Can that really be a coincidence? Section 2. Elements of religious and philosophical context. Element 30. Early first century Judea was at the nexus of countless influences, not only from dozens of innovating and interacting Jewish sects, elements 2 and 33, but also pagan religions and philosophies, elements 31 and 32. The influence of the latter is sometimes denied, but cannot be, not only because pagans lived, traveled, and traded all throughout Judea, with significant populations in cities throughout the Holy Land, from the pagan quarters of Caesarea, Gaza, Ptolemais, Tiberias, and Sepphoris, to the 10 cities of the Decapolis and major port cities such as Tyre and Ashkelon, and likewise in Samaria, which was right in the center of the Holy Land, with ongoing interactions with the surrounding districts through pilgrimage and trade. But even more so because Jerusalem and all Judea was frequented by millions of pilgrims from the diaspora every year. Many, such as Philo of Alexandria, were thoroughly Hellenized, who brought with them ideas and teachings from the foreign communities they came from. Acts 2 and 6 are thus reflecting the reality, and that in Jerusalem itself. Even Mark Chancy, in The Myth of a Gentile Galilee, confirms there were plenty of Gentiles in Galilee as well, predominantly in its cities and cities adjacent, just not as many as some scholars have claimed. Note, for example, his discussion of pagans in Samaria and his overall conclusion. But influence only requires a presence, not a huge one. Contact is contact. Likewise, see the discussion of the Gentile presence in Judea before and after the Hasmoneans, and one must remember that influences that had already been integrated with various sects of Judaism before the Hasmoneans would have remained after them. In Jack Pastor, Land and Economy in Ancient Palestine. Ironically, attempts to deny this also confirm it. The Christian apologetic treatise by Paul Eddy and Gregory Boyd, The Jesus Legend, extensively documents and thus concedes the vast presence of foreign influences throughout the whole of Palestine. The authors then try to insist that all Jews in Palestine were completely resistant to all these influences in almost every respect, which is an absurd notion and a conclusion they completely fail to prove. The fallacies of argument from ignorance and false generalization are rife throughout, especially in repeatedly leaping from premises about most to conclusions about all, and in mistaking opinions for facts. Ultimately, even their own conclusions show some Jews did not resist such influences. The Christian sect was simply among them. These foreign ideas would have infiltrated Palestinian society in two ways. Some would arrive by simple report, pagans and Jewish pilgrims retelling what they heard and knew and what they thought about it, and likewise bringing books with them to loan, sell, or read aloud. It would also be incredible to think that none of the cities in Palestine had public libraries, which were otherwise a standard feature of major cities of the time, and surely a feature of every city with a large Gentile presence, such as Caesarea or Tyre. But others would arrive through prior syncretism. Diaspora Jews combined pagan religious and philosophical ideas with their own Jewish faith, as Philo of Alexandria did, and just as what were then mainstream Palestinian Jews had done before when they adopted notions of hell and resurrection and the devil as a supernatural enemy of God, all from their pagan Zoroastrian overlords centuries before. And then these people came to Judea and promulgated their ideas as Jewish ideas rather than pagan. Paul himself is an example, a diaspora Jew from either Tarsus or Damascus, whose own version of Christianity, ultimately accepted even by the founders, the pillars of Galatians, was laden with ideas from pagan philosophy, literature, and mystery cult. Two common objections to this conclusion are, one, that the ideas exhibiting influence, such as in Philo or Paul, are in many ways different from their ideological sources, and two, we do not have direct archaeological confirmation of the presence of such ideas, for example, in the form of pagan books or references to same. But neither objection is logically valid because, one, syncretism always changes the adopted ideas by plucking them out of their original system and combining them with other ideas, and therefore differences are expected and thus cannot argue against the existence of influence. And, two, almost nothing survives from ancient Palestine that would be relevant to determining what wasn't there in the first century, certainly in terms of books, much less in terms of orally transmitted texts and cultural knowledge. Therefore, this is simply not a valid argument from silence. The premise is also dubious, since we actually do have archaeological evidence of pagan influence on Second Temple Judaism in the Dead Sea Scrolls, where clear pagan influences on the Book of Giants and even the Book of Enoch have been identified, and yet nearly a dozen manuscripts of Enoch were recovered from Qumran, and Enoch was a seminal text in the origin of Christianity. In contrast, the evidence of transmission vectors heavily transiting and residing in Palestine, as I just surveyed, is conclusive, and to suggest that all those transmission vectors were there year in and year out for centuries and not transmitting anything is to argue against all human probability. Likewise, though someone like Philo or Paul could light upon one idea or two that was only accidentally similar to pagan counterparts, it is massively improbable that they could do this dozens of times over. Such a coincidence has only one plausible explanation: influence. Some people have a hard time grasping the fact that parallels can entail influence even when many differences remain. One of my readers suggested I make this point with West Side Story. It's nothing like Romeo and Juliet, taking place in 20th century America, with Latin gangs fighting Anglo gangs who fight with fists and knives and not swords, and they aren't families, just gangs, and no one is named Romeo or Juliet. Yet to claim West Side Story was not influenced by Romeo and Juliet would be absurd. It's a deliberate emulation. This is the case with all acts of myth-making and syncretism. The variants of a theme will obviously differ in countless ways, but the parallels that remain are too specific and too numerous to exist by coincidence. Direct emulation and borrowing are simply by far the most likely hypothesis in such a case. Moreover, as both Philo and Paul wrote in excellent Greek, as did the authors of several of the books found at Qumran, and numerous persons in Palestine transcribing and thus also evidently reading Greek inscriptions and grave markers, and Greek could then only be learned in pagan-style schools based on pagan models of pagan literary classics and commentary, which would undeniably transmit pagan religious and philosophical knowledge, to suggest there was no transmission of pagan knowledge and ideas there is to suggest the absurd. Though very conservative Jews, who should not be conflated with all Palestinian Jews, distinguished learning Greek from studying Greek philosophy, some philosophy and religion inevitably were taught when studying under an ordinary grammarian, who used pagan books to instruct by and gave commentary and glosses on their content, such as a passage's meaning and significance. Thus, avoiding the philosophy schools could not have prevented exposure to philosophy. And not all Palestinian Jews were arch-conservatives anyway. Even at Qumran, we have undeniable evidence of advanced Greek writing and education. Considerably more evidence of this has been recovered from Masada and Jericho. Finally, one might concede the knowledge existed, but that, quote-unquote, the Jews, would never adopt ideas from foreign cultures and religions. That is a dubious premise. History does not support it. But even if granted, what conservative or elite Jews would do can have no bearing on what desperate, radical, or fringe Jewish sects would do. And Christianity did not originate within conservative or elite Judaism, but from the radical fringes, as a protest movement against conservative elite Judaism, and thus represents the very kind of heresy conservatives were always combating, as we see in element 2. By the very fact of their being heretical, any innovations such an embattled sect might resort to in order to reform the Judaism of their day would not be confined to what conservative Jews would allow. In fact, anthropological precedent tells us syncretism in that case is actually likely, as we see in element 29. And ultimately, such adaptations, even if we can see their pagan roots, would always have been marketed as Jewish, not pagan, exactly as happened to Jewish adaptations from Zoroastrianism. Element 31. Incarnate sons or daughters of a god who died and then rose from their deaths to become living gods granting salvation to their worshippers were a common and peculiar feature of pagan religion when Christianity arose, so much so that influence from paganism is the only plausible explanation for how a Jewish sect such as Christianity came to adopt the idea, again as we saw in Element 11. For example, you won't find this trend in ancient China. No such gods are found there. If Christianity had begun in China, its claims would indeed have been unique and astonishing. Yet, in its actual Greco-Roman context, it was neither unique nor astonishing. Thus, it cannot be a coincidence that Christianity arose with an idea matching a ubiquitous pagan type unique to the very time and place it was born. Any theory of historicity, to be plausible, must take this into account. In the middle of the 2nd century, Justin Martyr wrote the following, quote, "When we say that the Logos, who is the firstborn of God, Jesus Christ, our teacher, was produced without sexual union, and was crucified, and died, and rose again, and ascended to heaven, we propound nothing new or different from what you believe regarding those whom you call sons of God. In fact, if anybody objects that our God was crucified, this is in common with the sons of Zeus, as you call them, who suffered, as I previously listed. Since their fatal sufferings are all narrated as not similar but different, so his unique passion should not seem to be any worse. Indeed, I will show, as I have undertaken, and as the argument proceeds, that he was better, for Jesus is thus shown to be better by his actions." End quote. Thus, even Christians acknowledged the ubiquity of the dying and rising Son of God mytheme in their surrounding pagan culture, and recognized it as a common theme even when every story differed in details from every other. On that being how syncretism works, see again Element 11. The dying and rising son, sometimes daughter, of God mytheme originated in the ancient Near East over 1,000 years before Christianity and was spread across the Mediterranean principally by the Phoenicians, the Canaanites, from their base at Tyre, and after that by the Carthaginians, the most successful Phoenician cultural diffusers in the early Greco-Roman period. And then fostered and modified by numerous native and Greco-Roman cults that adopted it. The earliest documented examples are the cult of Inanna and Dumuzi, also known as Ishtar and Tammuz, the cult of Baal and Anat, and the cult of Marduk, also known as Bel or Baal, which basically meant the Lord, all of whose resurrection stories are told in Sumerian, Ugaritic, and Assyrian tablets, respectively, long predating the advent of Christianity. That in pre-Christian belief Inanna was indeed killed and her corpse resurrected, I already demonstrated in Chapter 3, providing the most indisputable example. These cults then influenced the development of others in the Greco-Roman era, including the cult of a resurrected Adonis. Although too few pre-Christian texts about this specific Adonis cult survive to reconstruct its liturgy, in the 3rd century the Christian scholar Origen says, in his comments on Ezekiel, that Tammuz is still worshipped in his day under the name Adonis, and as such, quote, certain rites of initiation are conducted for him, first, that they weep for him since he has died, second, that they rejoice for him because he has risen from the dead, end quote, by way of explaining the reference in Ezekiel to women, quote-unquote, weeping for Tammuz at the gates of Jerusalem, in Ezekiel 8, verse 14, which Ezekiel was denouncing as pagan. We know that refers to the resurrection story of Inanna, which we have on clay tablets long predating Christianity, and there is evidence of a corresponding resurrection story for Tammuz, already widely known in Jerusalem long before Christianity, as Ezekiel was attesting. Zechariah 12, verse 11, also mentions, quote, the mourning of Hadad-Rimmon in the valley of Megiddo, end quote, this being a known epithet of the Ugaritic Baal at the time, who became the resurrected savior god of the Greco-Roman era mystery cult of Jupiter Dolichanus. And in the case of Tammuz, or Dumuzi, we have the pre-Christian resurrection story for his consort Inanna, and it has long been suspected that the complete cycle traded resurrections between Inanna and Dumuzi, as Origen's comment implies, and recent discoveries have supported this conclusion. Recovered fragments imply a period of rejoicing after mourning the death of Dumuzi, or Tammuz, which would indicate he too recovered from his death, a similar cycle of mourning and rejoicing over the death and revival of the god Attis would develop later. It is difficult to reconstruct the belief system of early Attis cult. The evidence is either scattered or late, and from what we do have, it seems his ordeal might have been the periodic return to life of an eternally preserved corpse, which would be an example of a variant of the same mytheme, but one too far removed from the norm to make an ideal example. But nevertheless, pre-Christian myths clearly had Romulus and Osiris and Dionysus torn apart and risen to glory. Dionysus is killed and resurrected as a baby, the others as adults. And there were other savior god stories involving death and resurrection, including in one or more of the Adonis cults. It is far more likely the resurrection of this Adonis in the cult to which Origen refers, not all Adonis cults were necessarily the same, had been celebrated long before Christianity began, than that it would be a recent innovation. Surely Origen would know if it were, and make obvious sport of the fact. It would likewise be incredible that even at this early stage, major pagan cults would fundamentally change their entire religion in emulation of Christianity, which was a little-known, wholly uninfluential cult that was rarely liked. Contrary to claims that Christianity was booming in its first 2 centuries, it was in fact an extremely small fringe cult until the later 3rd century. And indeed, Lucian directly attests to there being a resurrection myth for the Syrian Adonis half a century before Origen, and it's clear Lucian is relating an ancient ceremony of its celebration, not some recent novelty. Lucian records, like Origen, that national ceremonies of mourning for his death are followed the next day by celebrations of his returning to life and ascending into outer space. So it is far more likely a resurrected Adonis cult was not new. The more so as we can confirm several other examples of clearly pre-Christian dying and rising gods well known across the Roman Empire. The savior cult of the resurrected Zalmoxis of Thracian origin is clearly attested in Herodotus centuries before Christianity. The imperial cult of the resurrected Romulus is likewise attested in several pre-Christian authors, as we saw in chapter 4. And the Egyptian savior cult of the resurrected Osiris is likewise undeniably ancient. Well before Christianity, inscriptions among the Egyptian pyramids had long declared of Osiris, usually in the voice of his sister wife Isis, quote, "I have come to thee, that I may revivify thee, that I may assemble for thee thy bones, that I may collect for thee thy flesh, that I may assemble for thee thy dismembered limbs. Raise thyself up, King Osiris, thou livest." End quote. Or, quote, "Raise thyself up, shake off thy dust, remove the dirt which is on thy face, loose thy bandages," end quote. Or again, quote, "Osiris, collect thy bones, arrange thy limbs, shake off thy dust, untie thy bandages, the tomb is open for thee, the double doors of the coffin are undone for thee, the double doors of heaven are open for thee, thy soul is in thy body, raise thyself up," end quote. It is absurd to insist there is no parallel in concept here to what would later be claimed for Jesus. Jesus is clearly very much like Osiris. Both die, and both get raised in improved bodies, and both end up living as lords in heaven, not on earth. As surveyed for Element 14, Plutarch is explicit about the cosmic version of the Osiris myth. He says Osiris actually incarnates and actually dies, albeit in outer space, but he dies too, as Plutarch admits, also in the myth that places his death on earth at a single time in history. And he says he is actually restored to life in a new supernatural body, just as Jesus was, as Paul thoroughly explains in 1 Corinthians 15. Plutarch uses cognates of anabiosis, return to life, and palingenesis, born again, which are undeniably clear in their meaning. Other tales as well, Plutarch says, agree with, quote, "what is said of the dismemberments, returns to life, and rebirths of Osiris," end quote. For Osiris, Plutarch has this event repeated only annually, as was also likely the case for Ishtar and Tammuz. But that's not a relevant difference, since syncretism with Jewish apocalypticism fully explains the replacement of a cyclical with a one-time resurrection. In fact, the peculiarly Jewish logic of that modification is fully explained in Hebrews 9, as we will see in Element 43, and again in chapter 11. Similarly, the resurrections of Romulus and Zalmoxis were and remained singular events in history, and likewise in public myth, that of Dionysus, demonstrating the flexibility of the myth theme in just this respect. I already discussed the example of Romulus in chapter 4. Speaking of the entire genre of incarnated dying and rising gods, Plutarch writes, quote, "Now we hear the theologians affirming and reciting, sometimes in verse and sometimes in prose, that God is deathless and eternal in his nature, but due to some predestined design and reason, he undergoes transformations of his person, and at one time enkindles his nature into fire and makes it entirely like everything else, and at another time he undergoes all sorts of changes in his forms and his passions and powers, even as the universe does today, but he is still called by the best known of his names. The more enlightened, however, concealing from the masses this transformation into fire, call him Apollo because of his solitary state, and Phoebus because of his purity and stainlessness. And as for his turning into winds and water, earth and stars, and into the generations of plants and animals, and his adoption of such guises, they speak in a deceptive way of what he suffers in his transformation as a tearing apart, as it were, and a dismemberment. They give him the names of Dionysus, Zagreus, Nyctelius, and Isodites. And they narrate deaths and vanishings, followed by returns to life and resurrections, riddles and myths, quite in keeping with his transformations," end quote. Thus, Plutarch attests to there being many historical narratives of pagan gods becoming incarnate and dying, their corpses vanishing, and rising from the dead, which are meant to allegorize what is really going on, which, as he implies here and explains elsewhere, is more cosmic in nature, as we saw in Element 14. But the myths were still there, and everywhere known. In fact, the component of vanishing corpses as a mythotype for translation to heaven is demonstrated to have been a commonplace in pagan literature of the time, by Richard C. Miller. He shows this theme was so distinctive of pagan traditions as opposed to Jewish literature that it is unlikely to have come from anywhere else. That translation to heaven was almost always understood by pagans to be bodily, typically by the assumption of a new, indestructible divine body, I demonstrate in my chapter on the spiritual body in the book The Empty Tomb, particularly in regard to Philo, who often uses words such as incorporeal to refer to what he actually means are physical bodies of astral material. The public ubiquity of dying and rising god myths, always the divine sons or daughters of a supreme god, and often being worshipped as personal saviors, is therefore beyond dispute, and could not have failed to play a major role in the origins of Christianity. Otherwise, we must posit an extremely improbable coincidence. Element 32. By whatever route, popular philosophy, especially cynicism and to some extent Stoicism and Platonism and perhaps Aristotelianism, influenced Christian teachings. Scholars generally agree that pagan philosophies influenced Paul, for example, debating only to what extent Paul modified their ideas by combining them with Jewish ones to create something new and different, the very definition of syncretism. The influence of cynicism has been particularly argued and debated in recent scholarship, but most of this debate talks past the point. It is not necessary to suppose that the hypothetical Q document or any of the sayings of Jesus directly emulate cynic sources, although that is a hypothesis deserving consideration. Rather, there could also have been influence from cynics and cynic philosophy on the Jewish sects that later influenced or grew into Christianity, possibly even just orally through itinerant cynic preachers, but still also possibly by written sources. And it is this influence that cannot reasonably be denied. Even apart from whether or not such concepts and teachings originated with a historical Jesus, there are undeniably cynic elements in the Gospels. These could be simple borrowings from cynic teachings circulated everywhere by adopting those that were attractive and merging them with Jewish moral values similarly selected from those commonly available to produce a more ideal hybrid. Much of this may already have preceded Christianity through other Jewish sects, and some of it may have come together as the Christian movement formed, and some possibly introduced after. By the nature of syncretism, again, the differences, the cynic ideals that were not adopted, or were modified, or even rejected and replaced with contrary Jewish ideals, do not argue against adoptions and adaptations. Just as their many differences from other Jewish sects did not mean the Christians were not influenced by Judaism, so also their differences with the cynics did not mean they were not influenced by cynics. As in religion, so in philosophy. Eclecticism, the combining and melding of philosophies and the picking and choosing of ideas and ideals to produce unique combinations, more or less favoring yet still differing from one sect or other, was the norm, as we saw in Elements 2, 11, and 30. The first century Stoic philosopher, Musonius Rufus, for example, shows clear signs of having been influenced by cynicism, and in result, taught things very similar to Jesus, concerning, for example, charity, pacifism, forgiveness, and brotherly love. And if that can be so for him, it can be so for Jesus, or anyone in the Christian tradition after him, or the Jewish tradition before him, and so, too, any other popular philosophy of the age. Element 33. In addition to its pagan influences, Christianity was also obviously influenced by several Jewish sects, as we saw again in general in Elements 1 through 5. And it can be understood only in this context, too. This means the role must be considered not just of the Old Testament and many other Jewish scriptures then revered, as we saw in Elements 6 through 9, but of specific Jewish sects and their distinctive ideologies and innovations, many of which we do not in fact know much or anything about, such as the so-called Galilean sect, whose particular beliefs, apart from being somehow opposed to the Pharisees, are otherwise unknown. Christianity is a syncretism of pagan and Jewish salvation ideology, and as such differs from each precisely in what it borrows from the other. Therefore, both must be understood, or at least be on our theoretical radar. Even considering what is known, influences have been detected from the Pharisees, especially the liberal branch associated with the pre-Christian Rabbi Hillel, the Essenes, and or the sects represented at Qumran, and certainly the Baptists, the pre-Christian Jewish sect led, if not founded, by John the Baptist around the assumed time of Christianity's birth, and possibly also the therapeutai, or whatever sectarian influence they and Christianity share in common, or even the Samaritans. The more these influences are examined, the less original Christianity appears. The Beatitudes, for example, are barely more than a redaction of a pre-Christian Beatitude literature recovered from Qumran. And the collection at Qumran by no means represents all the literature that would have been available to the first Christians. Indeed, even what was there survives now only in scraps and fragments. In other words, we barely have a fraction of what was at Qumran. Think of all the new ideas, scriptures, concepts, interpretations, variants, genres, and precedents we have discovered just in these fragments. And then realize what must be the number of other ideas, scriptures, concepts, interpretations, variants, genres, and precedents there were in those times that we have not discovered. Hence my point in Element 9. This makes it impossible to argue that anything now thought peculiar to Christianity did not derive from some pre-existing Jewish precedent in one of the well-known sects or one of the lesser-known, which has simply become lost in the scarce transmission of evidence from the past, hence my discussion in Element 2. It must also be considered that Jewish sectarianism was often not associated with formal institutions or control hierarchies and would therefore have been extremely fluid. For example, a sect of Essenes could adopt many of the teachings of the Pharisee Hillel and then go on to see itself as the genuine expression of the Baptists and thereby look like all three sects, which would make classification challenging, but ultimately unnecessary, since it really doesn't matter whether we identified it as an Essene sect, or a Pharisee sect, or a Baptist sect. No matter what we chose to call it, it would still be a hybrid of them all, and we would still need to attend to how it was influenced by each. As I've mentioned, this kind of eclecticism was a cultural fad of the time, characterizing philosophical schools as well as the sciences. So it would be natural to see it anywhere experimentation and innovation were especially rampant, and this was certainly the case in first century Judaism. Element 2. Element 34. Popular cosmology at the dawn of the Common Era in the Middle East held that the universe was geocentric and spherical and divided into many layers, with the first layer of heaven, often called the firmament, being the foundation holding up all the others, and consisting of all the air between the earth and the moon, or sometimes the same term only meant the topmost part of this, the sphere traveled by the moon. This expanse was known even then to extend hundreds of thousands of miles. That the distance to the moon had to be in the hundreds of thousands of miles was argued, then famously, by Aristarchus, and later proved by the equally famous astronomers Hipparchus and Posidonius, over a century before the dawn of Christianity. Above that were several more levels of heaven, the number varying depending on the scheme adopted, but the most commonplace view was that there were seven in all, one for each major celestial body. The region from the moon to Mercury being the first, then on to Venus, the Sun, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, not always in that order, and finally the sphere of the stars. Astronomers tended to regard the stars as distant suns. Theologians tended to favor the theory that the stars comprised a single layer of lights at the top of heaven. This view was particularly popular with Jewish theologians and readily accepted by the earliest Christians. This model had already been read out of scripture even before the explosion of scientific discoveries that began in the classical period, the 6th and 5th centuries BC, and took off in the Hellenistic, the 4th through 2nd centuries BC. As Genesis said, quote, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters," end quote. Then God creates and separates light and darkness, producing the first evening and day, and then, quote, "God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters above from the waters below, and so it was done. And God called the firmament heaven," end quote. And that was the second day. Then, quote, "God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear," end quote. And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas. In this account, God does not create ex nihilo. There were primordial waters, and a formless and empty earth. Genesis 1, verse 1, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth," is a summary heading of what's about to be described, not the first action God took, as is clear from the fact that God does not name the heavens until he separates it out of the primordial waters, in Genesis 1 verses 2 to 8, and God does not name the earth until he makes it appear, in Genesis 1 verses 9 to 10, out of material already present, Genesis 1 verse 2. God began creation by separating the primordial waters, which he did by forming a solid dome, in later cosmology a sphere, called the firmament, rakia in Hebrew, or stereoma in Greek, a solid body, often the foundation or framework of a building. In this account, the firmament is called heaven, but it's clear what is meant is the floor or basement of heaven, heaven itself being the waters above the firmament. The rest is the world below, including the earth and its seas. In Genesis 1 verse 20, birds are allowed to fly above the earth, but kata to stereoma to uranu, across the firmament of heaven. So the firmament was not just the roof of the first heaven, but the whole sky holding up the heavens, the place where birds fly. The term could thus refer to the region of the air or its ceiling, depending on the context. At the time Genesis was written, it was thought all the stars and planets and sun and moon were located on the same level, and thus Genesis says God attached them all to the firmament. Genesis 1 verses 14 to 17. So there would be the atmosphere up to the firmament, the place of clouds and air, the firmament itself with all its stars and sun and moon, then the heavens above, the place of the celestial waters, effectively a three-level system. But by the time Christianity began, astronomy had been well established and its basic findings more widely known, and thus it was known that the moon is on one level, the sun on another, the planets on yet other levels, and the stars beyond, as Paul himself was aware, as we see in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 41, which is what expanded the levels imagined for heaven to at least seven. The structure of heaven is debated in the Talmud, but the general opinion resolved there is that there are either two heavens, the firmament and the heaven of heavens above it, or there are seven heavens, which were interpreted in different ways. In one scheme, the first heaven is just the sky, or the lower part thereof. The second is the firmament separating that sky from the other heavens and containing all the stellar objects, such as moon, sun, and stars. The third is where millstones grind heavenly grain into manna. The fourth contains the heavenly Jerusalem and the temple and the altar, where the archangel Michael, the great prince, pays cult to God. The fifth is where the angelic host resides. The sixth contains warehouses of hail and snow and rain. And the seventh is where reside the souls of the righteous dead and the souls of those yet to be born, as well as a magic water that resurrects the dead. So says the Talmud. But the actual contents of each heaven could vary from account to account. One Enoch and two Enoch both incorporate a seven-level heaven in their accounts, as did the ascension of Isaiah, as we saw in chapter 3, where again there are seven heavens, and the firmament is beneath them, holding them up, consisting of all the air above the earth and its ceiling. And the distance between the earth and the top of this firmament is explicitly said to be vast. Likewise, among the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Song of the Sabbath Sacrifice, 4Q400 through 407 and 11Q17, also describe seven ascending levels of heaven, with different temples and thrones and angels in each. Similarly, the first century Testament of Levi, the third book of the Testaments of the 12 Patriarchs, gives a different account of the seven heavens and what's in them. Yet that's just another example of a great many narratives that can be found in early Christian and Jewish literature. So this notion of seven heavens, with the heavenly firmament at the bottom, separating the earth from the higher heavens, had certainly become a fundamental Christian doctrine. It was clearly a component of Christian belief, even from earliest times. Paul assumes Jesus will descend from heaven, Uranos, and then snatch us up into the clouds, Nephelai, to meet him in the air, Aer, meaning the terrestrial part of the atmosphere, in other words, the firmament. Thus, he distinguishes heavens above from air below, in 1 Thessalonians 4. And Paul mentions, without assuming anyone would challenge him or even think twice about it, that he knows a man, probably himself, who traveled up to the third heaven in 1 Corinthians 12 verses 2 to 4, where he says the Garden of Eden was located, a common belief in Jewish cosmology of the time, as we'll see in element 38. Element 35. Popular cosmology of the time also held that the subheaven, the firmament, was a region of corruption and change and decay, while the heavens above were pure, incorruptible, and changeless. This view was most widely popularized by Aristotle, and then by philosophers after him who adopted it, though many did not, and it remained a debated topic in science well into the Roman era. Nevertheless, it was such a good fit for religious beliefs of the time that theologians clung to Aristotle's original scheme. This was especially popular among those who favored Platonism in their construction of the universe. For example, Plutarch confidently asserts that this terrestrial universe, or the perigeos, the stuff around the earth, and the moon along with it, is irregular and variable and ever-changing, whereas this is not true of the rest of the universe, the regions above the moon. The same view of things is affirmed by the famous pre-Christian author Cicero, Paul's predecessor, and by the Jewish theologian Philo, Paul's contemporary. It is repeated or assumed in countless cases across pagan, Jewish, and Christian literature of the period. Paul clearly embraced this view himself and assumed his Christian congregations did as well. For example, in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 40 to 50, Paul divides the world into the region of decay, the terrestrial world, the epigeia, the earthly places, meaning on or above the earth, and the region of indecay, the celestial world, the epurania, the heavenly places, meaning in the heavens, which distinction is also reflected in 2 Corinthians 5. This is the same division of worlds that Plato, Philo, and Plutarch described. As Philo attests, this notion had already been assimilated in pre-Christian Jewish thought. Element 36. Because of this division between the perfect, unchanging heavens and the corrupted sublunar world, most religious cosmologies required intercessory beings who bridged the gap between those worlds. So God need not descend and mingle with corruption. This concept can already be seen in the cosmology of Plato. It only became increasingly popular thereafter. Thus, Plutarch tells us that there are holy demons, daimones, guardians of men, which interpret and serve, being intermediary between gods and men, since they stand up above the prayers and requests of men, and take back down to us revelations and gifts of blessings, and thus act as intermediaries, intercessory beings, between men and gods. Plutarch also says, it is not the gods, but demons, daimones, the ministers of the gods, who are in charge of oracles and temples, because the gods themselves are too lofty to descend and deal with men. This view had become fully assimilated by many sects in Judaism. Thus, in the ascension of Isaiah, as we saw in chapter 3, we also hear of mediator beings who had to travel up and down through the heavens to carry gifts and communications between men and God, even needing passwords to open the gates from one heaven to the next. The very same concept was taught in Mithraism. The Jewish theologian Philo provides the obvious explanation. God does not condescend to lower himself to the sublunar world, so he sends angels and intermediaries to help and communicate with mankind. And it is these beings who deliver revelations and commandments, and the most important of these intermediary beings was the divine Logos, as we'll see in Element 40. But remember again my discussion earlier of the equivalence of angels and mediary gods in Chapter 4 and in Element 11. Thus, as Origen says of Jacob's dream in Genesis 28, verse 12, quote, "A divine vision was presented to the view of our prophet Jacob, a ladder stretching to heaven, and the angels of God ascending and descending upon it, and the Lord supported on its top," end quote. Which he says tells us there are indeed many heavens and beings that travel between God and man. This is the same view reflected in John 1, verse 51, where we see, quote, "And he said to him, Truly, truly, I say to you, you shall see the heaven opened, and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man," end quote. The same notion is represented again in the fact that it is the Holy Spirit that descends at Jesus' baptism, Mark 1, verse 10, while God does not deign to descend himself, but only shouts from his station above, Mark 1, verse 11. Jesus was clearly regarded as one of those beings. Romans 8, verse 34, 1 John 2, verse 1, and Hebrews 7, verse 25, all establish that Jesus' role was to advocate on our behalf in the presence of God, one of the common roles of an intermediary deity. In 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 16, Jesus, not God himself, descends from heaven to collect us. In Hebrews 4, verse 14, we're told Jesus, quote, passed through the heavens, end quote, for us, descending to effect his death and ascending to accomplish its effects, which is also affirmed in Ephesians 4. For similar reasons, Mithras was called the mediator, mesites. Accordingly, Jesus was also called the mediator, the mesites. Irenaeus further explains Jesus' role as a mediator deity. Quote, the baptism of our resurrection proceeds through these three points. God the Father bestowing on us resurrection through his Son by the Holy Spirit. For as many as carry the Spirit of God are led to the Logos, that is, to the Son. And the Son then brings them to the Father, and the Father then causes them to possess incorruption. Without the Spirit, it is not possible to behold the Logos of God. Nor without the Son can any draw near to the Father. For the knowledge of the Father is the Son, and the knowledge of the Son of God is through the Holy Spirit. And according to the good pleasure of the Father, the Son ministers and dispenses the Spirit to whomsoever the Father wills, and in whatever way he wills. End quote. This was not out of line with Jewish theology of the time, which had many similar notions of mediator beings negotiating between earth and heaven and God and man. In the ascension of Isaiah, for example, a mediator being, an angel, must descend to carry Isaiah through the many heavens and back again, and another mediator being, Jesus, must descend and reascend to accomplish his tasks on God's behalf. As Paul regarded Jesus to have been a pre-existent being who humbled himself, died, and then was exalted very high, as we see in Philippians 2, he clearly understood Jesus in the same sense as the intermediary beings common throughout Jewish and pagan theology. It was through Jesus that God accomplished all things, even creation itself, as we see in 1 Corinthians 8, verse 6, and now our present salvation, as we see in Element 10. Jesus is thus the intermediary agent of God's will from above, and this was a common concept in both pagan and Jewish religious thought. Element 37. The lowest heaven, the firmament, the region of corruption and change, was popularly thought to be teeming with invisible spirits, pneumata or psuchai, and demons, daimones or daimonia, throughout the whole space, who control the elements and powers of the universe there, meddle in the affairs of man, and do battle with one another. In pagan conception, some of these demons were evil and some were good, and the good demons were often intermediary deities, as we discussed in the previous element. In Jewish conception, all the demons were evil, defying the will of God, and they did the bidding of fallen angels who also set up residence in the firmament, who were once intermediary deities serving God, but who were cast down and took up residence in the lower realm. And the leader of these fallen angels was Satan, also known by many other names, for example, the devil, Belial, Beelzebul, Lucifer, Samael, or just the adversary, the literal meaning of the word Satan. Satan had once been God's servant, but was often at odds with him. Then, in the intertestamental literature, under the influence of Zoroastrianism, which also had an adversary, who represented evil and darkness and waged war against the God of good and light, Jewish theology began to convert their adversary into the same role. Stories were then developed of a time when Satan rebelled and was cast down from heaven by God, trapped in the lower realm, where he then set up dominion. Many of these stories stemmed from associating the serpent with Satan, and then interpreting the Genesis story of the serpent's fall as the story of Satan's fall. For example, Wisdom 2, verse 24 says, quote, it was by the envy of the devil that death came into the world, end quote, a reference to the Genesis tale, in which it is by the wiles of the serpent that death comes into the world. Christians adopted this view, as we see in Hebrews 2, verse 14. This led to reinterpreting Satan's role in stories such as that of Job, which in cosmic history occurred after Satan's fall. Many angels were cast down along with Satan, who then took sexual liberties with the first human women, the progeny of Adam and Eve. And one of the products of these unions were the demons, malevolent spirits, a notion arising from the interpretation of a curious story told in Genesis 6. These demons and fallen angels then brought abundant evil into the world, requiring God to drown everyone in the great flood. A version of this story is told in 1 Enoch and 2 Enoch, for example, and another in the Book of Jubilees, and different versions appear in various other places. For example, it is assumed in Philo's treatise On the Giants that the angels mating with human women in the Genesis tale are demonic beings, and we likewise hear of the same in Irenaeus, Demonstration of the Apostolic Preaching, chapter 18. But the flood only destroyed all flesh, not the demons or fallen angels. Thus, the firmament still came to be dominated by countless demons, invisible, malevolent spirits, who were ruled in turn by the fallen angels, who had set up their own thrones, dominions, and principalities in the firmament, in mockery of the heavenly thrones, dominions, and principalities occupied by obedient angels appointed by God, as, for example, those arrayed in the fourth heaven, according to the Testament of Levi. And these demonic angels were ruled in turn by Satan, the prince, or archon, of demons, as we see in Mark 3, verse 22, Matthew 12, verse 24, and Luke 11, verse 15. As we hear in the books of Enoch, quote, "One from the order of the archangels deviated, together with the division that was under his authority. He thought up the impossible idea that he might place his throne higher than the clouds which were above the earth, and that he might become equal to my power. And I hurled him from the height, together with his angels, and he was flying around in the air ceaselessly above the abyss." End quote. And so, likewise, the division of angels under his command who rebelled with him. This demonological view of the universe was fundamental to Christianity's understanding of why the world needed Christ's sacrifice and how that event functions soteriologically. Everything that was wrong with the world was due to these demonic beings and their influence and power in the sublunar realm, separating man from God, particularly by infecting and corrupting the Jewish and pagan elite, among whom were the very priests charged with mediating between man and God. So these forces had to be magically defeated, and God had to be reconnected with men directly through a new back channel that bypassed all demonic and angelic power and influence. These were not novel ideas. The pagan world was awash with similar thinking. It was commonly thought that, quote, "the whole air is full of invisible souls, which are called demons, and some of these are heroes," end quote, that is, demigods, "and these are the beings that send men dreams and revelations." In other words, intermediary beings, as we saw in Element 36. Thus, for example, Plutarch tells us that Isis and Osiris were originally great demons, or daimones, which he explains are neither gods nor men, but something in between, being divine but also incarnate, which come in varying degrees of good and evil. As a result, there are great and strong beings in the atmosphere, he says, the periaikon, the surrounding air, that are evil and delight in blasphemies and other perversions of religion, and are the cause of all manner of bad things that happen from the forces of nature. But there are also, quote, "holy demons, guardians of men," end quote, which serve men and gods as intermediaries. And these beings, though usually immortal, are capable of suffering and dying because of their dual nature. Accordingly, for their heroic service, enduring suffering and trials, Plutarch says, quote, "Isis and Osiris were transformed through their virtue from good demons into gods, just as later Hercules and Dionysus were," end quote. And now they have supreme power over all domains above and below. But to renew and maintain his control over the universe periodically, Osiris descends into the firmament, where he acquires a body that is then killed in a struggle with the demons there. And with the assistance of Isis, he is resurrected and reascends to heaven in his immortal divine body. In the popular cosmology of the educated, which was more informed by the sciences of the time, the realm of the dead was also transferred from an underworld, which made less sense now that it was known that the earth is a sphere, up to the firmament. Plutarch, for example, explains that Hades is actually the region between the earth and the moon, which is filled with all manner of souls and spirits, including the souls of the dead, which ascend as high as their virtue allows, sins being imagined as weighing souls down, just as in Egyptian mythology, as we discussed in Element 11. While virtuous souls, accordingly, were so light that they float all the way to the top. Some even live on the moon, like a cosmic Isle of the Blessed. The heavy souls, meanwhile, weighed down by their sins, become, in this scheme, evil demons. This is why the sublunar realm was peopled with demons. Evil beings could not even ascend as high as the moon, much less to realms above it. Jewish demonology was structured similarly. but was more faithful to the original Zoroastrian picture of a cosmos at war between sons of light and sons of darkness, with the supreme evil deity, Satan, in charge of the latter. As we saw in chapter 3, the ascension of Isaiah says Isaiah was carried up by an angel, and together they ascended to the firmament, where they saw Satan and his hosts, quote, "and a great struggle was taking place there, and the angels of Satan were envious of one another," end quote. And likewise it says, "the firmament is," quote, "where the prince of this world dwells," end quote, along with countless demons, which he calls the angels of the air.